844-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In order to be able to sell arms, you have to produce insecurity first. At that, the U.S. can be relied upon for producing the insecurity that at least stimulates the arms trade. But having said that, even the most lapdog-inclined government starts understanding the trick now. Resistance builds up. So having said that, I have mentioned difficulty with method number one in handling the weak dollar. What's method number two? You could do it with a very simple decree. You change the dollar bill overnight, and anybody who has old dollars, goodbye. If you want to redeem your bonds, try come and get it. In other words, it may be that those bonds can be written off as a loss. 92% of the U.S. deficit is covered by foreigners. 60% of it is covered by Asian countries, essentially Japan and China. Japan and China are covering the wars of the United States of America in order to guarantee their export markets, to make U.S. solvent enough to pay for the products they buy. Well, there is, of course, yet another method, which is to say, not only we export more, or we change the currency and you're not going to get it anyhow. And the third one would be to import less. Now try that with an impoverished American working class to deprive them of Chinese goods. Cheap East Asian goods. I don't think that is very workable. So imagine you screw the working class, you shift the wealth upward to the top 20% or 1% for that matter. You have the consumer price index rise more than the salary index, the wages index rises. You make the situation deteriorate, like the data show. So what do you pay people when you don't pay them dollars? Well, you can pay them Jesus currency. You can say that believe in Jesus and God will protect us against. You can also pay them cheap Chinese goods. So imagine you cut off that possibility. Well, then you're left with Jesus currency. This is another method called redistribution. The country's in a squeeze. The basic point about economic boycott is not the decline in profit. The basic point is the moral challenge. That will get to the USA the way it did to South Africa. U.S. companies abroad make an average profit of 6%. That means a 6% boycott is sufficient to make them reconsider their overseas investment. And that's the magnitude we have for the brands I mentioned. Some will ask for U.S. military intervention. But since this is done by private people and not by governments, it's not easy. South Africa was in that situation, and both Mandela and the last white president told me that what hit us and what worked was not the boycott of apples, that was not important for our economy at all, but it was the moral message, the message of disgust. Foreign students coming to U.S. went down 2.4% last year. There are many interpretations. One of them is U.S. foreign policy. My wife and I passed into Los Angeles Airport 2 days ago, fingerprinting on both index fingers and the iris scrutinized by some interesting device. I did not like it, and I say it with no smile. I didn't like it at all. So, let's go down the list. I mentioned the distribution and through with the economic factors. Let me take the next list, which is Ford, and those are the military contradictions. So by contradiction, we mean that the U.S. is pushing in one direction, and lo and behold, there is a counter push. Contradiction number four, and this is a list that I made in 1999 and made public in 2000 with a prediction that the U.S. empire is gone by year 2025. You'll remember my boasting of my Soviet prediction. Bush was elected in year 2000, and I reduced it by 5 years after having watched him for a couple of months and defined him as a so-called accelerator of the synergies and the synchronies. He is now re-elected. I have reduced it by 5 more years. So we are now down to your 2015. Between, number four is between U.S. state terrorism and terrorism. It is almost unbelievable that an elite can believe that you can behave the way, kill that many people, and there will be no reaction. It doesn't work that way. So let us say that you multiply by every person killed by U.S. forces by a factor of 10. The number of friends, family, those who are bereaved and feel something in their heart, a sting. So suddenly you're up to not 12 to 16 million, but 150 million. It's rather unbelievable that some of those 150 million, for instance, 19 Arabs, shouldn't get the idea of doing something about it. And yet my interpretation of 9/11 is somewhat deeper than pure revenge. My interpretation of 9/11 is the public execution of two buildings, not the people in it. I don't think that was important to them. I think it was the buildings, for having sinned against Allah, for having intervened militarily, established bases with Jews and Christians in them. And on top of that, for having foisted upon a Wahhabite Saudi Arabia a consumerist lifestyle that they did not see as theirs. So if you look at it this way, it looks like we are caught in a vicious cycle between terrorism and state terrorism. How does that work right now? I mentioned that 5 countries were pulling out of the coalition of the willing. They have become unwilling. 6 countries in NATO have refused to train Iraqi officers. The numbers 5 and 6 will grow quickly. I don't have time to go into that. I'm just saying that the prediction is that the U.S. will be very alone. It's going badly, and that means that those who love the U.S. Republic are interested in how do we help U.S. get out. We're not concerned with getting out with honor. We're not concerned with that. But getting out in a way that in one sense teaches the U.S. a lesson, but in the other sense does something much more important, like an Iraq that could function. I'll tick off points. By countries like Japan and European Union establishing contact with the Iraqi resistance, with the aim of having a conference for security and cooperation in the Middle East after the model of the Helsinki Conference, United States as an observer, and as a possible point on the agenda, an Iraqi federation with Kuwait as an associated member, independent country, as a federation with democracy and human rights. But the Kurds, who right now are the ones who have benefited from what has happened, having their part. The Sunnis having their part by giving up the idea of being the instrument through which foreigners can run Iraq. And the Shias having an Islamic Republic in their part, but giving up the idea of running all of Iraq, according to that pattern. Now, the key to this is a federation. The obvious precondition is very simple. All foreigners out. All the decrees made by the U.S. administration and puppet administration declared null and void. You start from the beginning with a free Iraq. It's a tall bill. When Iraq is mentioned, the word Vietnam often comes up. I remember so clearly in the 1970s, where everybody said that if the U.S. withdraws, there will be civil war and chaos in Iraq, in Vietnam. They managed it extremely well. I go on to the next one, which is United States relative to the Allies. Well, the Allies are falling off, and they are rather important countries. We are right now, of course, mainly talking about Germany, France, Spain. Number 7, Number six is Russia, India, China. This could be the seat of the Fourth World War that Norman Podoritz is writing about in commentary in the September issue. They are coming closer than ever. The U.S. had a chance as long as the BJP was in power in India, because the BJP had given up two of Nehru's dictums, secularism and non-alignment. They went in for Hindutva and were contemplating a NATO for Asia with the United States. They lost the elections, to a large extent for that reason. That was not captured by the mainstream press. Well, as I said, 40% of humanity. United States is 6%. If you now go on to number seven, NATO versus the European Union Army. This is not necessarily to say that it is an independence declaration of the United States, which of course it is. But it's also to say that the European Union should be watched as a possible imperial successor. I'm afraid of that one. But for the United States, it means that there is an alternative source, and that countries, one after the other, will leave NATO, not formally but informally, and go to the European Union. Let me just add that of the 25 countries that Germany had occupied and brutalized during the Second World War, 18 are members of the European Union together with Germany. That's quite something. United States will have to revise quite a lot of textbooks, which was the German approach, in order to create friends among the countries they have brutalized. Number eight. United States, United Nations. That it is tense, we know. The rift between UN and the US will not only be France, it will be much more universal. Okay, number 10, 11, 12, cultural contradictions. Judaism, Christianity on the one side against Islam. There are 1.3 billion Muslims. And they have this unfortunate habit of not accepting the borders that we have been drawing in the sand of the desert and things of that type. It's high time we learned that. But leaving that point aside, the tragedy of this religious divide, of religion so similar with so much beauty in all three of them, mobilizing the fundamentalists on both sides, where the U.S. union of Jewish and Christian fundamentalism is intellectually brilliant. As far as I've understood it, reading Rapture books and other books, and once being visiting professor at the University of Virginia and Duke University, and each week traveling between Duke and University of Virginia, passing through Lynchburg. Now, the name is not very promising, but the cafeteria conversations are fantastic. And they brought me up to date with Armageddon each time I bought a hamburger. And I was willing to buy more than one hamburger in order to be in on biblical time. What I found, incidentally, in a footnote, was that my distinguished American colleagues didn't know their own country. They were living in some ghettos called Harvard and Yale and California, Berkeley, and places like that. Not the slightest contact with their own country. Okay, Lynchburg prevailed. But leaving that aside, how did the Jews and the Christians come together as fundamentalists? As far as I understand, by abolishing the old contradiction between not accepting Jesus as Messiah on the Jewish side, and seeing Jesus as God's Son on the Christian side. And the formula was simple. The second coming of Jesus Christ is the first coming of Messiah. Absolutely brilliant from the point of view of engineering a coalition. But it leaves out Islam. Anybody who can build bridges between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam deserves more than one Nobel Peace Prize. Now, these bridges are attempted built in this European Union OIC flirtatious exercise, and it will, of course, take place. But the European Union at the same time has very close cooperation with ASEAN, and they are silently, softly fomenting an East Asian community. Of the Mahayana Buddhist Confucian countries, Japan, the Korean Peninsula, China, Taiwan, of course, maybe Vietnam. In 1999, they had the first conference. Why is there a Western European community and not an East Asian community? I'm not going into the debate, I'll just say, these things are coming. And these are among the things that U.S. resents most, an East Asian community. Now, dear Washington, there's a handwriting on the wall, read it. Don't try to fight it, it'll come, whatever you do. If you try to resist it, it'll come a little bit sooner. Join it, welcome it. And maybe one day there will be not only one euro, but one Asia as a currency. Maybe one day it will be a global currency, but it will not be dollar. That will not be the global currency. Its days are past. They have peaked. Now, having said that, there are two others that are not so significant but important. There are other civilizations that feel trampled upon by the U.S., not only Islam. It is Hinduism, it is Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism in China. It is the Andean civilizations, the Inca, the Mexican Aztecs, the Mayas. There are grumblings and rumblings in all those places. And the signals are nothing good for Washington. This is, of course, also true for number 12, the European elite culture. The tremendous strength of U.S. culture has been its vulgarity, its guaranteed plebeian nature. It's reaching everybody. But that not in an evil sense of the vulgarity of the Coca-Cola and the hamburger, but also its universalism and generosity. And its way of embracing everybody if they're willing to play the game, the way it has been defined by the U.S. This is a weak one. The contradictions that are most important are growth versus distribution, productive versus finance economy, economy versus nature, terrorism versus state terrorism, U.S. versus Russia, India, China, U.S. versus UN, U.S. versus European Union, Judaism, Christianity versus Islam, and the world opposition. Now, the biggest demonstration in human history was, of course, the 12 million people, the 15th of February last year, in 600 places in the world, organized by the World Social Forum, Porto Alegre, Bombay. To have 12 million people come out in 600 places and then be wiped off the historical screen by Bush saying these are focus groups. The conclusion drawn by people all over the world is that the U.S. is not going to listen to words. Other languages have to be used. The solution of speaking with violence is not one generally accepted. Economic boycott then becomes a natural way of doing it. Okay, if you don't listen, we are not going to take you on and in. In that there is a message, and you will read it. Sooner or later it'll come to you. How does this work now in practice? Well, I'll tell you a little story from my own family. When I was 15, 1945, my sister and her coming husband had been fighting very much against the German occupation, like we all did. I was almost peeing in my pants, carrying illegal papers to school, distributing to another guy and things of that kind. She came back, having barely managed to escape to Sweden, came back in October 45, to the great delight of my parents and myself. And they announced, we have become communists. I did not quite understand what this communist stuff was. But I asked my sister, why are you, what was it again, communist? And she said, for two reasons. The war against Nazi Germany was not won by England and America. It was won by the Soviet Army. They were the ones who sacrificed. What the Anglo-Americans did was to kill, kill, kill in bombing. Point two, Soviet Union is the only country that has taken the bottom of society seriously and attended to their health and education and so on. And I had learned something about dictatorship, so I said that, having been through the war, and she said, yes, that's true, but that's only a phase. So, now the following happened. The first book denouncing the Soviet Union and revealing the truth of Stalinism was by a Ukrainian called Igor Kravchenko, who became a refugee in Canada. And his book was called I Chose Freedom. Now, remember now that this was long before Solzhenitsyn. And you must see me as a 15-year-old boy. And I'm now observing my beloved sister. She took that book and threw it in the wall. Bang! Whereupon she picked it up and started reading. Phase one, total denial. It's all lies. Phase two, this Kravchenko is a traitor. It's probably paid by somebody. Phase three, okay, okay, there is something to it. But it's only because of Stalin. You get rid of Stalin and everything will be okay. Phase four, okay, 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 it was not only Stalin, something in the structure was wrong. One party, dictatorship for the proletariat. Okay, phase five. The whole idea was wrong around the beginning. And then comes quite often phase six. Blind anti-Sovietism. Totally incapable of appreciating some of the good things they did. Like supporting anti-colonial war. About all of these you can ask question marks, and there's a yin and a yang and a yin and a yang to the yin and a yang and a yin to the yang and you di-di-di-di-di. And all of that is complicated once you start analyzing it. But I lived through these phases in two persons I loved. I see exactly the same all over Europe now in relation to the United States. They're really U.S. filiacs will deny every sentence in what I have just said. Next phase. I'm a traitor. That's probably because he didn't get the position. He wanted to get foreign minister, and fortunately he's not. So that's the reason why he talks the way he did. Look, I'm totally satisfied with the power that I have in the world, and I wouldn't like it decreased by becoming foreign minister in a small country. Now, point three. This is not about the U.S., it's about Bush. And if you could only get rid of Bush, everything would be okay. Yeah? And if you have been protected by lack of knowledge about the country you have adored and which has so many adorable characteristics, as I have mentioned, the U.S. Republic, then you don't know that Kerry might even in some regards have been worse. Point four, there's something wrong in the whole structure. And up comes the anti-capitalist critique. Up comes the anti-Pentagon, anti-military critique. Point five, there's something wrong in the whole culture. And that's when you start looking at this chosen people kind of business. My friends, what's happening now around the world is that people are going through these stages. And they go through them quickly. I think it's important that it doesn't end in blind anti-Americanism. So I stop at that point and the debate starts. Thank you.
You were just listening to Johann Galtung on the decline and fall of the American Empire. He spoke at the University of California at Santa Barbara in 2004. Johann Galtung of Norway was a leading advocate of nonviolent solutions to resolving conflicts. He died in late March 2024 at the age of 93. This special program is in his memory. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, unembedded nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Johann Galtung on the Decline and Fall of the American Empire, and for the classic Noam Chomsky book, Global Discontents, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
When the internet first started, ad revenue wasn't a big deal. But Canadian internet advertising has grown by 1,000% since 2005. 80% of that Canadian ad money goes to American internet companies like Google, Facebook, YouTube, and many more. Meanwhile, Canadian media, especially local news, are struggling again. It's time to close this loophole. It's time to help our struggling local media and raise new tax revenues for the things that matter to Canadians.
Learn more at friends.ca/closetheloophole.